This morning, we are going to talk about the people who followed Jesus. More specifically, we're going to look at who the people are that Jesus pursued to be his disciples. We're going to explore what the implications of that are for us and what that means. Even though we don't often feel the need to use our imaginations after about the age of 11, we still do. We just don't pay as close attention to it. For example, if I wanted you to experience 85 degrees, you would need to use your imagination at this point, right? But we do use our imaginations. We're going to, when we talk about the people that followed Jesus, our default mode, I think, is to look around us at the people that we are familiar with, look at the communities and the neighborhoods that we're in, and assume that that's reflective of the neighborhood and community that Jesus was in. We just have that assumption. That's the way our imagination works. We take what we know and impose what we don't know on it. Well, we're going to learn a little bit about Jesus' neighborhood here. That's why I have my Mr. Rogers sweater on today. We're going to do the neighborhood examination. So to do this, though, we're going to have a little audience active interaction. And I promise it won't be embarrassing or anything. I won't make you do anything that crazy except just move around for a few minutes. We're gonna shift ourselves and regroup ourselves. You're not going to stay there permanently. It's just for this exercise, all right? So if you're able, I'm going to have everyone stand up. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you to regroup yourselves based on some demographic information. And it's up to your interpretation of it. Some of you are a little bit more aware of age groupings than others. So I'll leave it up to your interpretation. We're not going to call anybody out on anything. Okay? So what I want is men who are 45 years old or older, and women who are 50 years old or older. Men 45 and up, women 50 and up. So go to the back of the room, just in that back area. And just stay standing. So men, just camp out in that back part of the room. And I'll explain what this means in a second. I'm going to have children, children and teens. If you're 5 years old, if you're 5 years old and if you're a girl and you're between 5 and 13, to come up here. If you're a boy and you're between 5 and 19, come up here. So girls, 5 and 13, boys, 5 and 19, come right up here to the front. All right, we have two. All right. All right, ladies, 14 through 39. Ladies, 14 through 39, let's have go over here. So ladies, 14 through 39. And then men, 20 through 45. So men, 20 through 45. And then women, somewhere in the vicinity of 40, over to that side of the room. Okay? I know I'm being cruel in separating you out, but this is part of the exercise. Okay? All right, so here's what we've got here. All of you in the back of the room, if we're talking about Jesus' neighborhood, about the time and place where Jesus lived, statistically speaking, you are all probably dead. I'm sorry to inform you of this. But to realign it, this has particular consequence for us as we talk about Jesus' followers, because if you think about Jesus' disciples, think of all the classical art you've seen of Jesus and his disciples, right? Who are the people that we typically picture around that fire? Men with not a lot of hair on their heads, but a lot of it on their faces, right? And that tends to be the men who are in this category. Unfortunately, the art is wrong, more than likely, because you guys just wouldn't be there. Statistically speaking, that's the case. A couple of things with life and death with us while we're talking about you guys. The estimated infant mortality rate in the Roman world was 314 children would die for every 1,000 that were born. In the United States right now, it is 6. The infant mortality rate in the United States is 6. In the Roman world that Jesus was a part of, it was 314. The worst currently right now is Angola at 175. And that's with AIDS. So we're talking about a world that Jesus lived in where death, particularly death in young people, was very normal and a normal thing to happen. The key age in the Roman world seems to be 10. Because when you look at the statistics, the older you get, the longer you live. That just, like, that makes sense, right? The older you get, the longer you live. So if you made it to 10, your life expectancy jumps significantly. For a one-year-old, the average life expectancy is 25 years old. So we're talking, this is a culture familiar with death. All right, so for the children then, we've got a little bit of a spectrum here. This is actually helpful. So with little kids, there was, once they hit 5, in particularly Jesus' neighborhood, once they hit about our elementary age, there was not necessarily a public education system, but some sort of a religious education system that a lot of kids would go through once they hit about age. You're 5, right? That's why you're up here?
No, 6.
You're 6. All right. Look, I'm off. So about 6. And then for girls, there was some education in Jesus's Galilean culture. But any education would end by the age of 13 because around 12, 13, 14, that's when girls would get married, typically. Again, there are exceptions, but typically girls would get married around that age. That's why we have all the teenage girls, if there are any here, over there, because by the time you're that age, you're married. But guys, you're older than 14. How old are you?
14.
You're 14. All right, so 14, typically the education system would cap out around 14, but guys wouldn't get married until they're around 20 because now they have to go through an apprenticeship. They have to get a job. You got to get a job. Before you can get a woman, you got a job. So that's just wisdom throughout the ages, isn't it? So 14, 15, 16, 17, they start an apprenticeship. Usually the family trade, whatever it is, start learning that. So there's an age discrepancy in marriage, which leaves you guys, because what we have with you is the widow class. Because men would die younger, because their jobs are more strenuous, the risk of them dying is accelerated, and women would live longer. And you would marry younger to an older man who would die younger. So you've got this age gap between having a husband die and dying yourself. So we have a very specific widow class. That's why we have a number of widows in the stories in the gospel and in Acts about widows, because there's a whole class of women that are widows because of the way the culture worked. And then all of you are the family people. You're married, you got kids, you're working your jobs, you're doing all that kind of stuff, which some of you are, but some of you might feel like, I am nowhere near that age. All right? So this is Jesus' neighborhood, all right? Not you guys, unfortunately. But this is more what it would look like, all right? So as we explore who Jesus' followers are, we put this kind of context. So thank you for participating. You can go ahead and find your seats again real quick. A couple of observations on some things that are different with our culture. There's no functional adolescence for Jesus' culture. There's no functional adolescence is the time period between when you reach sexual maturity and you enter adulthood, right? When you enter sexual maturity, we understand what that means. When you enter that, and then the time in your life when you start adulthood. Adulthood, kind of sociologically, is defined by marriage, career, and family. So children. So for a 13, 14-year-old girl, they would reach sexual maturity and almost immediately enter adulthood because there's almost no gap there between those two things. For boys, there's a small adolescence. So adolescence, as we understand it today, is an understanding that we only have now in the last 100, 150 years of what functional adolescence is because of the way our culture has shifted. And that's not to necessarily make commentary on that other than just to point it out that we've eliminated not just, in Jesus' culture, not just all the retirement age. We've not just eliminated that. We've eliminated this whole adolescent culture that we have within our world. So this gives us a little bit of background for Jesus' neighborhood. What I want to do now is turn to Matthew 4, and we're going to start looking in the scriptures at Jesus calling some disciples and doing that. Actually, Chris referenced a couple of these scriptures when he started this series that we're in as we move toward Easter, where we're looking at the Gospel of Matthew and exploring some of the themes, some of the ideas within Matthew specifically. And today we're going to talk a little bit more about Matthew in particular, but we're going to explore this idea of Jesus' followers as Matthew lays them out. So Matthew 4, verse 18 is where I'm going. As Jesus was walking beside the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon called Peter and his brother Andrew. They were casting a net into the lake, for they were fishermen. "Come follow me," Jesus said, "and I will send you out to fish for people." At once they left their nets and followed him. Going on from there, he saw two other brothers, James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John. They were in a boat with their father Zebedee, preparing their nets. Jesus called them, and immediately they left their boat and followed him. All right, so a couple insights on this calling of Jesus' first disciples. A little bit of context. I've talked about this a couple years ago, this Hebrew practice, but some of you weren't here a couple years ago, and for this context, it's going to help to refresh it. So we talked, particularly with the two young men up here, we talked a little bit about the age development and the educational system, where you've got some sort of grammar school for young kids, but by the time girls hit puberty, they're on to be married. By the time boys do that, they're moving on to get trained into the family business and start working. Well, there was one very small exception to this rule. This very small exception is part of the religious indoctrination system, part of the religious establishment, because you've got these rabbis who are religious teachers who are part of the culture, and they're supported through the synagogue system and some of this. But you've got these religious teachers, and part of what they would do is they would have a few disciples who would follow them, with the purpose being that they're training the next generation of religious leadership. This kind of like what we might call seminary education for these young men. And the way it would typically work is you have a rabbi who's teaching in an area, and you've got a number of these young people, young boys, who are coming up through the system, and they're memorizing the Torah, they're memorizing the scripture, and the more adept that they are, the longer that they would pursue it. Some kids just wouldn't have the chops for memorization, they wouldn't have the interpretive capacity to remember some of the teaching, they were better suited fishing, breaking rock, tilling a field. That's just the way it is. So they would fall out of the system as it would go along. But some kids would prove a real proficiency and a real capacity for memorization, for understanding the scriptures, for interpreting them and being able to apply them and storytelling on their own and some of these things. So these kids would kind of move up through the system. And I heard one analogy on this relating it to professional basketball. You know, lots of kids play basketball in middle school, right? In elementary school, lots of kids play. You've got all sorts of teams. You move up through the high school ranks, and they start having cuts. You know, you get up to JV, varsity. You have to make the team. You have to exhibit some proficiency at the sport and able to do it. And then you move on into college, and again, these are higher level people with greater skills, greater adeptness. And then there's the draft for the NBA, where you've got a few dozen young men every year who get picked to be a part of this thing. This guy said, I don't even know how to begin using his statistical analysis, but he said percentage-wise, what we're talking about is a very similar type of achievement. If you look at our nation and take that percentage, the percentage of young men in our nation, and then the percentage of young men in our nation who play in the NBA, percentage-wise, that's similar to what it would have been to have been called as a disciple for a teaching rabbi. That this is a very small, very elect group of young people who've demonstrated an incredible capacity to understand, to memorize, and teach the scriptures. So that was his, I don't know if I could argue that. But the normal process would be, a young man would go through the system, and then he would approach a rabbi and say, can I follow you? The rabbi would quiz him, would ask him questions, would put him through the ringer, and then would decide whether or not this young man could follow him to become his disciple, because what the rabbi is looking to do is to pass on his legacy. Each rabbi would have their own understanding of the scriptures, their own interpretation, their own application of it, and they wanted young men to come who would be able to absorb all of their teaching and be able to relay it exactly as they had taught it. So they're looking for people to follow to fill their capacity, right? They're thinking legacy of leaving this behind through these young people. So they're very, very selective. So when Jesus calls disciples, he's breaking with the traditional system. Because usually the rabbis were approached and asked to be followed. Instead, we have Jesus asking people to become his disciples. An interesting note here, we have young men who are fishing, right? They're already learning the family trade. They're already participating in the apprenticeship that will earn their livelihood for the rest of their lives. They've already been knocked out of the system, right? They already got cut from JV, so they started learning how to fish. It's already been determined by someone that their intellectual capacity, their ability to interpret and apply the scriptures is not good enough to continue on in the system. So with Jesus calling these disciples, we see Jesus picking people who are not good enough. Jesus is selecting people to be his disciples, to follow him, to train them in his teaching who are not good enough. They've been passed over by the system. And let me reinforce a little bit here, too. Matthew 17, I want to go there real quickly. Something that I think often gets looked over. Matthew 17, 24 says this, after Jesus and his disciples arrived in Capernaum, the collectors of the 2 drachma temple tax came to Peter and asked, why doesn't your teacher pay the temple tax? Yes, he does, he replied. When Peter came to the house, Jesus was the first to speak. What do you think, Simon? He asked. Simon, Peter, it's the same name. From whom do the kings of the earth collect duties and taxes? From their own children or from others? From others, Peter answered. Then the children are exempt, Jesus said to him. But so we may not cause offense, go to the lake and throw your line. Take the fish you catch, open its mouth, and you will find a 4 drachma coin. Take it and give it to them for my tax and yours. Now, there's some theological implications about being children of God and what that means and all this stuff that I'm not going to talk about. There's a real practical application here. The temple tax was a tax that was collected from every male 20 years of age and older. Jesus has quite a crew of young men following him around. The only ones that are required to pay the temple tax are the two, Peter and Jesus. So all that art, all those imagination that we have, the vision we have of Jesus and his disciples, of these older men with graying beards, the only two that were over 20 years old were Peter and Jesus. Jesus was in his early 30s. Peter probably somewhere in his 20s. He's got a younger teenage brother, Andrew. So of all of Jesus' disciples, his inner core, only two of them are 20 years old or older. The rest of them are a bunch of teenagers. This is how God decided to bring the gospel, right? Of all, this is profound. with all of history before him, as God, with all of history in front of him, looks at history and says, where and when am I going to introduce myself and bring redemption to the world? And then entrust those people to spread that message throughout the entire world. As God looks at the whole spectrum of human existence and says, where am I going to insert myself to ensure that as many people engage in this message and understand it and are transformed by it, where am I going to insert myself? What God chooses to do is insert himself into a system where a few young people spend a few years learning from, being taught by, eating and sleeping and doing life within a central message of a single teacher. So for God, he chose this discipleship model as the model through which he would introduce the kingdom of heaven. So he chose this system where there would be one person who would call a few people, who would have a few people who would follow him around and learn from him and spend their lives learning for a few years before taking that message on themselves and living it out on their own. That's the system that God chose throughout all of human history to embody the gospel in. Now, God, I'm getting ahead of myself here. So if God is a God of order, if God, that's what the creation story is, right? We have at the beginning, Genesis 1, we've got chaos and God brings order to it. God establishes a system and seasons and order out of this chaos. So if God is intentional, if God is bringing order, what is it that we can glean from this? Of what is God's intention here? What is it about these young people, these teenagers, that God decides this is the best way to introduce the kingdom of heaven, the story of the redemption of the world? What is it? What is God's intentionality here in choosing this way of doing it? Why is he up to it this way? Let's go to Matthew 9. I want to look here at this. Matthew 9 through 13 is what we're going to look at. As Jesus went on from there, he saw a man named Matthew sitting at the tax collector's booth. "Follow me," he told him. And Matthew got up and followed him. Again, this calling of Matthew comes before, chronologically, the story of Simon having to collect the drachma. So Matthew, again, is not 20 years old. Matthew's a young person, a teenager, functioning as a tax collector. While Jesus was having dinner at Matthew's house, many tax collectors and sinners came and ate with him and his disciples. When the Pharisees saw this, they asked his disciples, "Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?" On hearing this, Jesus said, "It is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. But go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice, for I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners." Here again, Jesus is breaking with the tradition of being approached. Jesus pursues and calls out someone and pursues them to be his disciple. In fact, when Jesus calls this disciple, it's kind of like he's on the playground. And instead of picking from the lineup in front of him, Jesus goes around the equipment shed and finds the kids who are smoking and has them come and be on the team, right? He's like, "You guys, you're on my team." So this is Matthew's call. This is the guy who authors this, who's accredited with authoring this gospel that we have. And we don't find him fishing. He's not farming. He's not even a hired hand. He's a tax collector. He's not even doing something that's a respectable Jewish job. Like, we've talked about this before. He's a tax collector. This guy is collaborating with the oppressing, invading army, right? This guy's a collaborator. This guy is obviously not a good choice. So why does Jesus pick Matthew? Well, if we just stuck to that story, I mean, right away, Matthew throws a party. So maybe Jesus picked him because sinners throw better parties, right? Is that Jesus's thing? Maybe. But that's not what this is really about. Jesus calls Matthew because Matthew is going to add an important dynamic to the group that Jesus is assembling. Matthew is going to fit a specific place that is going to help embody this idea of the gospel and the kingdom of God in a very real way for this little group of young people that Jesus is trying to help understand and help see what the kingdom is about. On your talk sheets, there's a big open space in the middle. And what I'd like you to do with that is, we've got an example if you want to follow the example, but otherwise use your own artistic merit. Draw a circle and four triangles, like you've got up there. The four triangles pointing in toward the circle. So draw the circle in the middle. We're going to fill in a couple things here with this and help, I think, illustrate what Jesus is up to. So in the circle, because this is Matthew's gospel, Matthew is the center of the story. Go ahead and write Matthew's name in that center circle. And if you want to write other things in there that would be appropriate to remember, you can remember with Matthew, he's a tax collector. He's a teenager. He is considered a sinner by others. He would be considered a traitor by some people. So this is who Matthew is in this center circle as we explore these relationships that we're going to have. Now, in one of the triangles, you could write fishermen. One of the triangles is another group. We looked at Peter, Andrew, James, and John, the four fishermen that are called, right, in that story. Chris went into this a few weeks ago, so I'll just hit on it briefly if you weren't here. There is the possibility that Matthew was the tax collector to whom the fishermen would have paid their taxes. Andrew and Peter and James and John. There's the possibility, maybe likelihood, but at least the possibility that Matthew was the tax collector that these guys paid their taxes to. And remember, we're talking exorbitant taxes here. These are fishermen. These are working men. These are guys who have blisters on their hands. These are guys who spend all night out at sea fishing and all day fixing their nets. These guys work hard for what little income they have, and then they're expected to pay a huge amount of that income to these tax collectors who are collaborating with the enemy. And maybe directly there's this relationship happening. So this is one of these triangles that we have here. Another one that you could add on there is closely related to it. We're just going to call it Nathaniel. We're not going to go into his story of his call, but he's connected to the fishermen. I think it's in John is when he shows up on the picture. They say, we think that Jesus is the Messiah, and that's how Nathaniel kind of comes into the circle. And what we think we know about Nathaniel is that we think that he came from a wealthy, probably a land-owning family. We think that he was a young man of considerable means. Now, when you're wealthy, the tax collectors know who the wealthy folks are in town, right? Because when you got margins to make up, you hit the wealthy because they're going to have the capacity to help you make up your margins. So you've got this wealthy young man having to hang out with the tax collector again. So this is Nathaniel's contribution. One of the other triangles we can put in there, James and maybe Judas. James and Judas. Sorry, this is the James and Judas. There are two Judai, and I was getting them confused. This is James and Judas. Now, while these two are specifically called as disciples, their whole families are along for the adventure. Right? It's not just these guys. Their whole families go along. Now, these are families. Their family is a family with no place in particular to be. You've got a family who decides that there are no roots to stick to, so when they're young, when their sons get drafted and called to be disciples, they just pick up wholesale and start following Jesus along. They have no roots. This is probably a very poor family. They've got nothing to stick around for. They come from nothing, they have nothing, so they just start following the circus, right? So this is a family with no wealth, no capacity. Now, if the wealthy have issue with the tax collectors, how much more do the poor have issue with the tax collectors? Because when you're poor, the tax collectors don't stop collecting the taxes. It then becomes an issue for the poor between eating and taxes win. So we have within this little entourage that Jesus is assembling, now these two poor brothers and their family traveling around with the tax collector, right? So this is another addition to the story. And now the last triangle is either one or two guys. We're not exactly sure. It depends on on how you translate a specific word. But these are the zealots, or the zealot. You can put the S in the parenthesis, maybe zealots or zealot. We have Simon, who we know for sure was a zealot. This is different than Simon Peter. Peter was the nickname that Jesus gave him, which means rock, which has all sorts of jokes associated with it, which you know that they were teenagers. This is more empirical evidence. You know that they were teenagers because one of them had a nickname, the Rock. It's more empirical evidence. So the Zealots were a homegrown terrorist organization. These were part of this group was part of the political movement at the time. These were also known as dagger men. These were guys who literally were trying to off-throw the occupation of the Romans through guerrilla tactics. They were fighting back and fighting back violently. They were assassins. They were known for carrying daggers, which they would assassinate any Roman they could get close to. And they would also, they were also known to assassinate collaborators. Tax collectors, right? So we know we have Simon and possibly Judas Iscariot, who's the one who betrays Jesus. Depends on how we translate the word Iscariot. It either is referencing a region where Judas came from, like a town and a region around that town, meaning of that area, or it means Judas the dagger, which if it means Judas the dagger, then translators believe that that's referring to his association with the dagger party, the zealots. Or it could be a little bit of foreshadowing to Judas's betrayal of Jesus. But at any rate, we at least have one zealot, we know for sure. All right, so this is the group that Jesus assembles. We have the fishermen who have to pay taxes to the tax collector. We have the wealthy who are very familiar and not comfortable with the tax collecting. We have the poor who starve because of the oppressive taxes. And we have the zealot who is interested in and not averse to assassinating the tax collector. And then in the midst of that, Jesus puts Matthew, the tax collector. This is the group that Jesus decides the message about redemption, the message about the redemption of the world needs to come through, is this group of people. Now you see why I put the triangles in. Because all these groups are pointing in toward Matthew. There would have been some serious friction going on in this group, right? And remember, again, teenage boys. The logic level and the capacity to control hormones is not real high among teenage boys. This is the group. This is the intentional purpose that God has for embodying the kingdom of heaven. This is how God decides to do it, with this group of misfits, with this group of people who cannot and will not get along. This is how God decides to show and demonstrate what the kingdom of heaven is like by putting these guys together. So the Pharisees object to Jesus eating with Matthew's friends. They object to this. For them, the question that they kind of raise almost resembles a mathematical equation. The question is this. The issue could be posed this way. It is in relation to purity, which is greater, sin or grace? In relation to purity, which is greater, sin or grace? Because the Pharisees were concerned about purity. So their assumption was that sin was greater than grace when it came to purity, because there wasn't grace extended to the sinner. You wouldn't have relationship with them. You wouldn't eat with them because sin was greater. But what Jesus seems to be demonstrating by the crew that he picks and the way that he embodies the kingdom of heaven is that grace is greater than sin when it comes to this issue of purity within the kingdom that Jesus was embodying. Jesus chose to spend his life and to have his mission in this world carried out by people who had chosen sin. You can write this down. This is the last talk, the talk note on there. Jesus chose to live his life with, and to embody his mission with people who had chosen sin. Matthew had chosen a life that was considered sinful. He was a betrayer. He had chosen this life of being a tax collector, who had been passed over. Peter, Andrew, James, and John, they had been passed over. They weren't selected. They were already working their normal lives. They were already on their way to being normal. And people who had preferred violence, we have at least Simon, who had preferred a life of violence to try and bring about the kingdom of Israel over a life of peace and waiting on God's provision for this kingdom. So what Jesus seems to be living is an understanding of the world where grace is greater than sin. And what Jesus seems to believe is that the experience of the kingdom of heaven will redeem hate and resentment in relationships. What Jesus seems convinced of is that the Spirit can use anyone to spread the message of the kingdom of heaven. Jesus seems convinced that this group of misfit teenagers is the best way to change the world. Because in this group, Jesus has the opportunity to spend a few years embodying this kingdom, demonstrating forgiveness, showing them how the Spirit moves and works. So the question for us then becomes, what does it mean to go and make disciples? One of Jesus' last encouragements, the Great Commission, go and make disciples. For Jesus, this is the frame of reference of what discipleship means. For his disciples, this is the frame of reference for what discipleship means. They don't see discipleship as praying a prayer, checking a box, signing on a line. That is not what Jesus is calling his disciples to do. What Jesus apparently is calling his disciples to do is find some people with whom you can do life and with them demonstrate what the kingdom of heaven looks like, so that after a short amount of time, they'll be able to go and do the same. They will have seen what life looks like in the kingdom of heaven and will be able to live that life and demonstrate it to others, so that others might learn what that life looks like and then demonstrate it to others. This is the pattern that God selects to inject the kingdom of heaven, the redemption of the world, into, is this pattern of discipleship. So then for us, if we believe that this is the redemption of the world, if this is what we believe we're called to, the question is, who are you discipling? Who are the people in your life that you feel called to embody, demonstrate, live through, and show what the kingdom looks like in the same way that Jesus did? It's a heavy question. I don't have easy answers for it. But this, as we go to the scriptures, this is the model that becomes apparent. That we invest in people, we demonstrate, we embody, and we spend years showing them what the kingdom looks like. And it's not going to be easy. I mean, look at our little diagram. That's friction. That's conflict. That's going to be messy relational life. But that's what Jesus intentionally chooses, is that. So for us as we go, consider that. What does it look like to embody? What does it look like to choose people who reflect these disciples. Will you stand with me? I'm going to pray and give you a benediction. Can you pray with me? May you go forth now into the world where apathy and half-heartedness, delusion and anxiety are dominant. Move the world a little, letting the world know that the church lives and breathes and lives in us. In the name of God, the Creator, Redeemer, and Sustainer, and the peace of God, which passes all understanding, keep your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. Amen. Amen. Have a good week.